The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Lolly Focus Pops or Lolly Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello and welcome to The Bunker Daily. I am your host, Alex Andreu. There is a deepening suspicion that politicians are out to serve themselves and not the country, said David Cameron in 2010, adding that the culture of excessive lobbying and quiet words in ministers' ears was threatening to do even more damage to the battered reputation of Parliament, and it was the next big scandal waiting to happen. Well, he was right. What he didn't seem to foresee is that he would be at the centre of that scandal. My guest today is the financial journalist Duncan Mavin. After reporting on the rise and fall of Greensill Capital for several years, Duncan has now written The Pyramid of Lies, a book of this extraordinary story. I know the term is overused, but if anything ever deserved the title expose, this does. And he is here to talk to us about it. Welcome to The Bunker, Duncan Mavin.
Thanks, Alex. It's great to be here.
Let's start with a little bit of personal filler, as it were. Who was Lex Greensill pre-Greensill Capital? Because it's quite an interesting story, isn't it?
Yeah, Lex was born in a very small town in Australia called Bundaberg. It's a farming community, fairly remote. This is very, very key to who he is, in his mind as much as anybody else's. So he was born into a farming family. You might imagine it's quite a sort of macho kind of culture. And Lex is not really a sporty guy. He's quite a small intellectual type guy. And this sort of plays into his sense of who he is, I think, for many, many years afterwards. You know, he's out to impress the jocks. This little chip on his shoulder grows and grows, I think, over the years.
Mm. Before we go on, from the way you're talking now, but also from the book, I sense a sort of underlying semi-affection for this character, certainly a familiarity that you have developed for him just from, you know, researching his every aspect of his life for so long.
Well, it's interesting you say that because it has been in the back of my mind from time to time. What do I think of Lex? And he is in many ways kind of an underdog for much of his career. And so you're sort of rooting for him, right? You know, this underdog guy who's, you know, not come from the sort of typical background that ends up in high finance. He's come from a very, very different background and he's trying to build something really new and different. So to some degree, you end up kind of rooting for him. You want this little guy to be successful. The problem is when things go wrong, he's not willing to admit that things go wrong. And sometimes that means doubling down on problems.
Now, Greensill Capital, why were so many people excited about its ideas about financing?
Yeah, well, I don't want to get too much into the technical stuff because it gets pretty dry. But essentially, Lex's pitch was that he was going to democratize finance. But what it was he provided a kind of financing called supply chain finance that typically is only offered to big corporations. And what it does is sort of help smooth the flow of goods and services between companies. It means that suppliers of goods and services don't have to wait 90 days or 180 days to get their money. But as I say, it's typically only offered to really big companies. Lex believed he had a way of offering that to much smaller companies. And that was kind of interesting, but in the post-financial crisis world, it was really interesting. So many governments have been trying to get money into their economies and make money move more efficiently through the system. And if, in theory, Lex was offering a way to do this.
Was that quite a disruptive idea? I mean, what I'm thinking about is that what you spoke about, this ability to smooth finance for large companies, it's quite a big competitive advantage, and one that they may not want smaller entrants to their markets to have.
It was definitely disruptive, consciously so, right? So Greensill Capital was very consciously trying to disrupt the way the banks had offered this kind of service in the past. Lex would talk about that. In fact, there was an interview on Sky TV at one point when Greensill was going strong, and the interviewer held up a copy of an article I had written and sort of waved it at Lex to say, you know, this is pretty negative about you. And he said something along the lines of, well, you know, haters gonna hate. When you're a disruptor, bad things come your way and sticks and stones get thrown at you. They were absolutely consciously trying to disrupt the banks. I think there was a sort of personal element to that too. So, you know, Lex had worked at Morgan Stanley and he'd worked at Citi, and it hadn't quite worked out for him in those places. And so I think there was an element of this that was Lex Greensill showing these banks how to do their job properly. You know, you might say that because he called it Greensill Capital, named it after himself, that shows how personal that was.
Yeah. Were there early alarm ringers? Was anyone saying, wait a minute?
So, yeah, there were. So throughout his career, there were people who were, you know, even when he was at the banks at Morgan Stanley and Citi, there were people who were saying, this guy, this is not right. This guy's pushing the envelope. He's going into areas we don't like. The problem was, you know, when the business is smaller and he's doing things that people don't like, nobody really feels the need to do too much about it, I think. You know, it's we're not going to lose billions of dollars. That comes later. And when that happens, you know, it's already too late. But there definitely are naysayers. At one point, Greensill Capital gets kind of caught up with a company, a giant kind of hedge fund asset manager called GAM. And there is a whistleblower there who stands up and says, hey, we've invested a lot of money in this stuff with Greensill, and I don't think we've done our work properly because I'm not very happy about what that stuff is. I mean, in that case, you know, as happens often to whistleblowers, the guy ultimately lost his job. That's really, you know, it's quite depressing, actually.
Mm. What about the regulator? Was there something that was causing them concern?
So the regulator is really interesting on this. Greensill Capital was set up in a very particular way that meant actually it didn't really have a really dominant regulator. So the company was registered in Australia. In theory, the Australians look after it, but doesn't do much business there. A lot of the funds it worked with were in Switzerland. So in theory, the Swiss would look after it, but actually they kind of only regulate Credit Suisse and they don't really look at the funds. He's got a bank in Germany that's regulated by the German regulators, but really they're only looking at that bit of the business. And then in the UK, they had registered in a particular way through an agent, which was a sort of light touch registration meant for small businesses and family companies and that kind of thing, not for multi-billion dollar companies. And so in a way, Greensill kind of hid in this gray area where nobody was really a kind of primary regulator. That said, there were red flags popping up at regulators all over the place, and they weren't really doing much about it. And I think if you look in the UK, the first inclination that the UK's financial regulators should have had that something was wrong was when this blow up happened at the hedge fund GAM I mentioned earlier with the whistleblower there. I, from my reporting, have seen lots of the documents that I know the regulator also saw. And to me, it's not understandable that they didn't act on it. Now, I suspect if you talk to people there, they will say, first of all, we don't have that much time. We've got a lot of things to look after. This wasn't a company we regulated. It was a company that was doing business with a company we regulated.
Yeah.
And secondly, you know, we manage trillions of dollars or trillions of pounds of funds. We look after all of that. this was really small when it happened. And, you know, we can't look at everything.
Yeah, it's interesting also with the size, with what you were saying earlier. There was a lot of this grey area, basically, where he operated, where sort of between being too small to notice and too big to fail, between being regulated and not regulated. How did it all start to go wrong in simple terms?
Well, there were a couple of things. So one, the business of supply chain finance actually isn't very profitable at all. And that's the reason why the banks only offer it to their big clients, because they don't make much money off it. They're offering it to clients typically because they've got some other business that is highly profitable. This is a kind of freebie they're offering up as a way to keep their clients happy. So Lex trying to be disruptive, Greensill Capital trying to be disruptive in that space, well, you're trying to be disruptive in a not very profitable industry. Mm. So in fact, what was happening at Greensill Capital is, on the one hand, there was a piece of the business that was kind of the core business, which was not really producing much in the way of profit at all. At the same time, as a fast-growing startup that's trying to get big investors interested, Greensill Capital needed to show a lot of revenue growth. And so what it was doing there, a lot of profit growth as well, what it was doing there was essentially just risky loans to risky companies. This wasn't supply chain finance at all. It was just lending to big companies or small companies that couldn't get loans elsewhere.
Yeah. And because of the way the financing worked, it was essentially lending other people's money.
Yeah. It had no, Greensill Capital didn't have any money of its own.
Yeah.
It was either tapping into money from the German bank, which was getting deposits from especially German municipalities, or it was tapping into money from Credit Suisse's investors who were putting money into supply chain finance funds that were investing in Greensill's assets, and wasn't any of it.
Which is a classic pyramid sort of structure. If at any point the clients coming in dry up, you have a lot of problems.
Exactly.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Duncan, why do you think people started paying more attention after companies involved with the scheme started needing government bailouts? I mean, I ask that both as a specific but also as a general question. Do you think there's a higher level of scrutiny the moment a company's fate, as it were, begins to impinge on public money?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it's interesting you say that. Why did it get more scrutiny? Because for me, I was looking at this company for a few years thinking, this is a disaster waiting to happen. Why is nobody paying attention to it? And so suddenly when COVID hit, my first instinct was, these Greensill guys will be all over the bailout money. This will be exactly the kind of money they will try and get their hands on.
It's interesting. You write that in the spring of 2020, while the rest of us were worrying about surviving COVID and lockdown, Lex Greensill was seeing a sort of golden opportunity in what you describe as an unprecedented pool of government money. Was it ultimately this overreach, you think, that exposed him, or did it merely hasten what was always an inevitable collapse?
Yeah, I think this government money, I think the COVID money extended the life of Greensill Capital.
It would have gone belly up earlier, basically, had it not been.
Yeah, they would have run out of money earlier had it not been for that cash. And what it did was it made it a mainstream story, right? This went from being a story about a sort of fairly obscure finance business that happened to have David Cameron as an advisor to, when it collapsed, hey, that's our money. That's taxpayer money. What's happened there? You know, and the fact that Cameron obviously was sort of caught lobbying through his text messages to his former colleagues, turned this from a story about an obscure finance firm that, you know, was doing essentially sort of risky practices and things that it didn't say it was doing, into a mainstream story about, you know, political wrongdoing and influence and the revolving door and so on.
I'm just interested in whether there is a parallel reality out there where a couple of factors go the other way, a couple of calls are made differently, and Greensill Capital still exists right now as a respected firm. Lex Greensill is still a respected person behind it, and the pyramid is continuing to grow, I guess.
I think there is an alternative reality, but it's very alternative because it probably requires most of the personalities at a senior level in this thing to not be there, right? So I think the alternative reality is that Lex and a few others recognize a couple of years ago that some of the loans they've made are not good loans, and they turn around and they write them off, and, you know, they take the hit and the valuation of the company drops and they have to sort of start again, and the growth is much, much slower, and they're not going to be billionaires. Maybe they're going to be multimillionaires, and it's going to take 20 years instead of, you know, 2 or 3 years. And, you know, in that case, yeah, there's a business there. But the reality is you would have to take out all of those people who were desperate to get rich really fast. And, you know, maybe the business doesn't exist without those personalities.
Yeah. Do you think that attitude towards the pandemic was unusual? Or are we likely, as legal cases on government contracts go on and the COVID inquiry gets going, are we likely to see more companies and individuals who saw the pandemic as basically a big cash machine?
Yeah, I mean, it's not my area of expertise, but to me, as a financial journalist, the big scandal of the pandemic and the handling of it is going to end up being the financing, the money that got lost, right? Mm. I mean, it's sort of, in my mind, similar to wartime profiteering, right? It's sort of a crisis. And while most of us are kind of, you know, trying to do our best thing to get through the crisis, some people are just sort of, you know, the pound signs kind of roll in front of their eyes, and they see it as an opportunity to get free money and not have to really work for it.
I read somewhere that what distinguishes the Greensill saga from other corporate scandals, and there have been many, is the way in which it encompasses and taints figures at the highest level of politics and officialdom. I mean, most notably, David Cameron, former Cabinet Secretary Jeremy Hayward. Would you agree with that assessment? Do you think that is the thing that makes it really quite unusual?
I think so. It certainly piqued my interest as a journalist way back when I first started to pay attention to this, and knowing that there were red flags around this company, and then hearing that a former prime minister was involved, your ears pick up and you kind of go, well, this is interesting now. I think that is what's made it unusual. And I would say there are other politicians, right, who got involved, who were on the boards of various Greensill entities. And it is unusual, I think. Part of the reason for that, I think, is Lex Greensill himself. I'm sorry to keep bringing it back to Lex, but it really is him. I think Lex, you know, was very good at understanding what motivated people. And so he would look at what's going to get them on board and bring them into my organization, because having them in my organization makes me more credible.
Yeah.
He actively sought out these people as a way to bring credibility to his firm.
It's an extension of influencing, as it's become known in many, many ways, isn't it?
Yeah.
They are political influencers.
Absolutely.
Selling their services on the equivalent of Instagram.
Door openers, right? And to be honest, I mean, what I heard from people inside Greensill was a lot of people were really disturbed by it, partly because they felt like, you know, Cameron was getting paid really well, and what was he really bringing to the table? You know, what does he know about supply chain finance? What does he know about, you know, fund management? In some ways, Lex was smarter than those people because he did know what that brought, and it was huge credibility.
Do we know what Lex actually thinks of it all? Does he still think it was all a jolly good idea? Does he feel betrayed by the politicians and industry tycoons who originally supported him but didn't stand by him?
So he's an incredibly self-confident guy. I think there was a couple of moments where he sort of said, "I did this. This is all my fault." However, there are a lot more moments where he says this was the fault of, you know, this other company, this was the fault of these guys over here, you know, if they just stood by us, it would have all been great. So I think it's not in his nature to be especially self-reflective and take the blame.
Yeah. Now, to begin to wrap up, I guess what I'm interested in is, has anything been done to make this happening again more unlikely at all? Are the international financial authorities talking to each other in a more meaningful way about stuff like this? Are politicians more careful about whom they are photographed with and that sort of thing?
There is some tinkering around the edges, I think. So actually, there have been some moves by global accounting regulators to tighten up the rules on supply chain finance. So that might sort of make some of what Lex was doing a little bit more palatable. You know, there has been parliamentary inquiries into lobbying by ex-ministers and ex-politicians. So far, though, the real action has been very limited. And, you know, this is always the way of these things. I think if you look at just about every financial scandal, there's a lot of talk, a lot of hot air, but ultimately very little happens.
Very little happens, yeah. There's an epilogue to the book, and some of it explains the ways in which Lex Greensill has sought to distance other ventures from what happened, has sought to distance his personal fortune, his family from it. Is it in part the corporate veil that just allows people to do these crazy experiments that have the potential to blow up, knowing that the worst case scenario for them, for him, is a very comfortable early retirement? I mean, it just seems like not much of an incentive to not take massive risks.
I think that's a real danger. But in this case, I would say there is a criminal investigation into Greensill in Switzerland. There's a criminal investigation into Greensill Bank in Germany. There are lawsuits flying around the world. You know, it's possible anything could come out of those. It's hard to know what's going to happen with that stuff, I guess. You know, there is a danger, as you say, that, you know, Lex goes down from 4 private jets to 1 and, you know, lives a very comfortable life and there is no consequence for this. I'm not, you know, I guess the consequence is you don't become this giant multi-billion dollar organization. Instead, you just become a multi-multi-millionaire with a fairly nice life. And yeah, that's a risk. And I think it's rare that authorities really clamp down, right? So I think the one time that happened was probably Enron. And that was in the US, where the authorities often are much more aggressive. I think in that particular case in Enron, if you look back at it, I think they essentially said, we're going to make an example of these guys. We are going to throw everything at it until somebody's gone to jail in that case. Is the political will here to do the same thing? You know, is the will of different parties that have been wrong there to do the same thing? I'm not sure.
Duncan Mavin, thank you so much for your time and your insight. Thank you for chatting to us.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on.
The Pyramid of Lies, Lex Greensill and the $1 billion Scandal is out now, and it really is a cracking read. Remember, there's a new Bunker pretty much every day, so don't forget to subscribe, review and rate us. We are also running a listener survey so we can better understand what you need from us. The link is in the show notes, and those who complete the survey will be in with a chance of winning some lovely merch. And if you really like our little podcast family, do consider supporting our work on the funding platform Patreon. Just search for Bunker Podcast Patreon. You are quite literally keeping these podcasts going. This is Alex Andreou in the Bunker saying over and out.
The Bunker was presented by Alex Andreou. The producers are Jacob Archbold and Yelena Sofronevich. Lead producer is Jacob Jarvis. Group editor is Andrew Harrison. Audio production came from me, Robin Leeburn, and the Bunker theme tune is by Kenny Dickinson. The Bunker is a Podmasters production.